Welcome to the Royal College of Physicians of Edinburgh's Case Notes podcast. Over the next few months, we're going to work our way around the body head to toe, exploring different body parts and organs and their history in a cultural, medical, social sense. We're going to hear from a historian or curator about their work studying these body parts and their history. And we'll finish up each episode by exploring some of the recipes that were developed in history to treat that part of the body. So welcome to the podcast, Head to Toe, as we make our way around the body. My name is Daisy Cunningham, and I am the college's heritage manager and librarian.
And my name's Olivia Howarth, and I'm a volunteer with the Royal College of Physicians of Edinburgh Heritage.
And today we've made it as far as the feet, which is pretty much the end. We started at the top and we've worked all the way down. So I got to start with the obvious, which is you and I had better not set off on the wrong foot. We don't want to have two left feet or get cold feet. We should put our best feet forward, jump in both feet first, land on our feet, start off on the right foot. If not, they will hold our feet to the fire and then we will be carried out feet first. Sorry.
I could love it.
And I don't know what all of those mean, but carried out feet first, for example, supposedly would stop the ghosts from returning. So you wanted the person's face to be sort of pointing away from the house or away from the church, because if they are looking back, then their ghost will remain.
Interesting. I know that there's all sorts of things about if you're dreaming of feet or if you have itchy feet, then you are meant to be going on a journey or an adventure. Or a period of great change. I mean, it's nice and vague there.
Yeah, it does feel a bit like one of those sort of horoscopes of a thing will happen to you or not. If you've ever looked at Egyptian art and thought it looks a bit odd or stylized, one of the ways in which it is stylized is that only royals have a left foot and a right foot. Less sort of prestigious or important people have two left feet, which is a sign of less status, perhaps a sign of an uncouth person.
Another thing about ancient Egyptian art is the letter B is the shape of a foot in hieroglyphics. So feet must have been important.
A few more sort of meanings behind feet. Flat feet could be taken as a sign of evil. The devil had cloven hooves, allegedly, like the goat. And so his followers would all be flat footed. So they would have an element of his sort of physique. And if you were trying to prove that someone was a witch, a flat foot would be one of the elements that you would use.
Conversely, I read that if someone's foot was high enough that water could flow underneath it, then they were destined to have fame and fortune and be a powerful leader.
I don't think I have that.
I'm definitely more towards the flat foot end of the spectrum. Yeah.
So I did get quite excited about shoes in general. I think what I found particularly fascinating is we often think of sort of the fancier shoes, the more expensive shoes involving the heel, and that is very much the case now. But for a very long time, it was about the toe and the width or the length of the toe demonstrating status. Heels didn't exist for quite a long period of time. They're a relatively recent invention. So in medieval times, it would all be about who had the biggest toe on their shoe. For a long time, it was the length of the toe, and the king would have the longest shoe. I imagine very impractical for walking around in. And then in the 1500s, it switches and it becomes about width. So you have these incredibly wide-toed shoes, 15, 16 centimetres wide, and they were called foot bags, duck bills or bear paws. Oh, my foot bags are massive.
I really want to get a ruler out at the minute because 15 centimetres seems incredibly wide for a shoe.
I mean, it in a sense kind of connects to things we talked about before about, you know, the wealthiest people are demonstrating their wealth not only through having expensive things, but also demonstrating that they don't need to be practical. These are not shoes that you can wear and do any sort of labour in. And so, yes, obviously, poor people are not wearing 16 centimetre wide shoes. if they are sort of the very poorest, wooden clogs are still very common, and then slightly higher status, you would have sort of, simple leather shoes. But the next phase is the buckle, and how big and how ornate and how encrusted with diamonds can you make the buckles on your shoes to a point where they are going to be very heavy. And heels only come in the late 1500s, and my understanding of it is it comes from horse riding culture, particularly from sort of Eastern cultures. The heel would, keep your foot in the stirrup, and then they are adopted by upper class people. One of the problems from a health and medicine perspective is that once heels come in the late 1500s, they stop having left and right shoes. It's very difficult to make left and right shoes with a heel, so they start making straight. Is what they're called, which means both shoes are exactly the same. You wear them in with your foot to fit, but they are the same. And that then results in all sorts of foot problems. And also, that's the rise of what are called, galoshes or overshoes, because people now have these shoes which are so impractical that you have to have a special shoe to go over your shoe to protect your fancy shoe from ever getting damaged. So they are really only for indoors, these shoes, because when you're outdoors, no one can see them because you're wearing your special galoshes. The thing that sort of really interested me is how contentious all of this was. So various places on the continent, particularly in England and France, but elsewhere as well, there's a thing called sumptuary laws. These are really sort of significant in the 1500s, but also kind of 1400s, 1500s, 1600s. There are sumptuary laws, which are essentially very, very rich, powerful people, including the monarchs themselves, don't like the growth of the middle classes. They don't like merchants who are becoming so wealthy as a result of trade and consumerism that they can also now afford these shoes, these incredible symbols of wealth. So sumptuary laws are brought in, which will often literally break down class status and say, this is the type of shoe that you are allowed to wear if you are a merchant. This is the type of shoe if you are a monarch. So there are rules that stop you from wearing shoes that are more than a certain width or length or height.
How dare you want to look fashionable?
And the rules obviously have to change because when it's fashionable to have a wide shoe, the rules have to be about that. When it's fashionable to have a long shoe, you need a new law about that. And one which particularly sticks out to me is in France, they passed a law saying that those who wear red heels, including red bottom shoes, have to be members of the royal court. So it is absolutely pinnacle of status is red soled shoes and red colored shoes in general.
I know where this is going. Monsieur Louboutin.
Indeed. So it creates this association with people. It has to. Now the association between a red bottom to the sole of your high heel is everywhere. There is a very specific logic to why it is a very status connected item.
Just to linger on the ancient Egyptians again, in the tomb of a physician called Ankh-Mahor, I'm going to say that wrong, from about 2400 BCE, there are carvings that depict masseurs attending to their clients' feet. And some people think that that is potentially depicting a form of reflexology. And then there's a papyrus called the Papyrus of Kahun. The author describes foot massage as a treatment for a woman who has aching legs and calves after a long walk. I'm like, that sounds incredibly romantic right now. And then ancient Greek Hippocrates describes how to treat feet and particularly corns, calluses, and other foot problems.
He was into cutting, wasn't he? I think he sort of almost prototyped some sort of device that was for the cutting of corns.
Yeah, I think it's where sort of early version of a scalpel.
I'm enjoying your facial expression, Olivia. But yeah, so I did have a look a little bit about corn cutters, which was literally the job description of people who dealt with corns for a long time. You were the corn cutter. And obviously, if you were very high status, if you're a king or queen, you would have your own personal corn cutter who would come with you when you would go on trips. And it just again shows just how bad the shoes were and how much of a problem they were having with the shoes that people needed their own corn cutter. Because for a lot of us, it's not enough of a problem that that's a job that you need. Usually, most recipe books from the 1600s, 1700s will have at least a couple of recipes dealing with corns. Swan dung was what I found. Arsenic was not uncommon. If you live near the sea, one of the options is make sort of a paste of seaweed. The other option is bathing your feet in urine. I'm sorry to say it does work. I haven't tried it myself, but it softens the corns and then you can sort of cut them off or scrape them off. And then in the 1700s, it becomes a bit more of a reputable profession. And, 21st century, we have the podiatrist. I think there's probably less urine involved.
I hope so.
For everyone's benefit, we hope so.
So one of the things that I thought about when I knew that we were going to record feet was chilblains, mostly because I have a vague memory of reading about them in novels and things. But then as I read into it, I'm like, oh, it's still a common thing that people get. So chilblains are cutaneous inflammatory lesions. You can tell I'm reading that off a screen, commonly occurring on exposure to cold and damp conditions. So they do affect your hands as well. And I realized I've read about them in Jane Eyre. So
Of course she did.
when Jane is at Lowood School, she describes getting chilblains because they didn't have enough clothing to protect them from the cold. And she says, I remember well the distracting irritation I endured from this cause every evening when my feet inflamed, and the torture of thrusting the swelled, raw, and stiff toes into my shoes in the morning.
It's beautiful writing, it conjures a picture.
There's lots of cures for chilblains. The medieval Bald's Leech Book recommends treating chilblains with a mixture of egg whites, wine, and fennel root. But then Nicholas Culpepper, he says grated horseradish and applying as a mustard plaster, which we now know increases blood flow, which might have helped, but it's generally thought that maybe just slowly bringing your body up to room temperature is the best way to deal with chilblains. It's also a really old-fashioned word. It sort of conjures Victorian to me, but actually, chilblain is an Anglo-Saxon word, chill meaning cold and blegen for sore.
I did not know it was that old. I agree with you.
My favorite one, Morton's toe, is when your second toe is longer than your big toe, and approximately 20% of the population have Morton's toe. The name comes from an American orthopedic surgeon called Dudley Joy Morton, and he thought it was a trait inherited from pre-human ancestors to help them grip with their feet and swing from trees. But in art, the more like protuberant second toe is known as the Greek foot, as opposed to the Egyptian foot, where all the toes taper down from the big toe, and the Roman foot, where the first three toes are equal and the last two are shorter. The prevalence of Greek foot in ancient Greek sculpture was due to it being an idealized form, and it's prevalent in Roman, French, Italian, and Celtic art. So the Statue of Liberty has a Greek foot or Morton's toe, as well as the Venus in the Birth of Venus, the Venus de Milo, and the Vitruvian Man.
I had no idea that there were specific different types of toe length in art. So that's fascinating.
I'm ashamed to say I don't have Greek foot.
I'm pretty sure no, I don't have Greek foot. But I will now be looking for Greek foot now that I know that that's a thing. If I go to an art gallery, I will be looking for examples of Greek foot, definitely.
I also have a really disgusting fact, which I don't know if it's suitable for this podcast, but are you
Go on.
interested to know?
I would like to know.
So between 2007 and 2018, several scientific facts converged to periodically deposit human feet on the shores of the Salish Sea between Vancouver and Seattle. And they realized there wasn't some bizarre murder spree happening. It's just that in water, human bodies naturally disarticulate, and hands and feet often disconnect from corpses that have been in the ocean for a long time. And when they are attached to a flotation device, such as a running shoe or a trainer, they're easily washed ashore, because the shoe protects them from being eaten by sea life as well. And because the water around the Salish Sea is well oxygenated, there's a lot of aquatic life. that could potentially skeletonize a body very quickly. So it was the fact that water flows into the Salish Sea from the ocean, and there's lots of disarticulated feet in the ocean, apparently.
Lovely.
Yeah, well, one of the things about this series of feet washing up was because there was more media about it, more people started checking random shoes on the beach.
Oh, yeah, I think I'd just leave that to someone else. In our case study today, we're going to look at the history of flat feet. Flat feet are simply when a person has very low arches, which flatten onto the ground when pressure is put on them. But the meaning placed on flat feet in history is much more complex. In medieval and early modern times, flat feet were often associated with witchcraft. Alongside other deformities or unusual characteristics, flat feet were characterized as a sign of evil or bad luck. In a similar vein, it was seen as bad luck for your first footer, which is a term for the first person to step over your threshold as the new year begins, to be a flat-footed person. Anything unattractive or unnatural was often characterized as dangerous, and flat feet was considered amongst those. By the 1600s, flat feet had been given the name Jewish feet. Flat feet became a symbol of the supposed superiority of white Westerners, and a tool of racism, of class, and of anti-Semitism. Flat feet were, of course, only one element of the pseudoscience directed against Jewish people over the course of European history, but it acted as a powerful symbol because of the existing association of flat feet with evil, but also because of their connection to masculinity and to military service. Because once we enter the 1900s, any connection in people's minds between military service and being a good citizen or a true man was undermined if you were deemed unfit for service due to your flat feet. And when it became clear, by analysis of military records after World War I, that actually those who were rejected due to their flat feet were more likely to be white and Protestant, this seemed to back up a new theory, that it wasn't just due to supposed racial differences, but due to over-civilization, to a too refined and too sedentary lifestyle. And the term flat foot began to be used in the US as a derogatory term for the lazy, the clumsy, the corrupt, and the lower class, particularly referring to Irish police officers. But flat feet continued also to be used by anti-Semites, particularly in Nazi Germany, as a way of supposedly identifying Jewish people, and also as a way of arguing for the supposed superiority of the Aryan figure, who, despite all the evidence to the contrary, supposedly had the perfect arches with not a flat foot in sight. This short clip is courtesy of the Wellcome Collection. It dates from 1962. In it, Dr. I.B. Snedden lectures on how to recognise and treat different varieties of fungal infection.
With the discovery of specific antibiotics, such as Griseofulvin, which have lethal effects on fungi, accurate diagnosis of fungus infections has become more important. But before employing an expensive antibiotic, the diagnosis must be confirmed by at least the finding of fungus mycelium in specimens of skin, hair, or nails, and preferably by culture of the fungus in the laboratory. However, most fungus infections do not need these expensive remedies, and it is possible to make a pretty accurate clinical diagnosis. Confirmation by the finding of fungus mycelium is well within the scope of anyone who possesses a microscope. By far the most common fungus infection is Tinea pedis, or athlete's foot, and it's becoming even more common. The reason for its increased incidence is that the fungus flourishes in warmth and wet, and there has been a tremendous growth of communal bathing in swimming pools, pithead baths, schools, and hotels. An infected person will scatter spores and mycelium on the floor, which will be picked up by the next person. At present, no satisfactory fungicide can be applied to floors to prevent such spread. Tinea pedis appears in two main forms: sodden, macerated skin in the toe clefts with painful fissures, which may become secondarily infected. This is perhaps the most frequent. Attacks start in hot weather, particularly after exercise, and even in the winter if people are wearing rubber boots for long periods.
Welcome to Recipes of Yore. We're going to explore some unusual medical recipes from the past. The way in which the word recipes was used in the past is a bit different from how it's used today. So it could mean recipes for cooking, for medicine, or even recipes for cleaning products or cosmetics. Very few of them were treatments we would recognise in the 21st century, and certainly none of these should be tried at home. Feet appear in historical recipe books in two main ways: as the site to be cured and as the entry point for treatments which then travelled around the body to the part that was hurt or in pain. So, for example, in one of our college's handwritten recipe books, this one belonging to a Mary Sayer and dating from the early 1700s, there's a recipe to treat fever in the head. Quote, "Take pickled herrings, do not wash them. Slit them and take out the bones and bind them onto the bottom of the feet. Shift them every 6 or 8 hours. Herrings on the feet was a surprisingly common treatment. One printed recipe book prescribed them, this time for swollen legs. Quote, "Take salt herrings, open them, pulling out the back and lay them to the soles of your feet. By doing this once per day for 7 days, you will experience the benefit." And a treatment for the swelling of the legs in yet another printed recipe book recommended, quote, "Take the white herrings out of the pickle, open them and lay the insides of them to the soles of your feet when you go to bed, and let them remain all night, and in the morning apply new ones again." But when feet weren't having herrings strapped to them, they were often being treated for a common foot-based complaint, corns. Early treatments for corns included beef suet, powdered frankincense, and fig juice. The ancient Greek physician Hippocrates recommended the removal of corns altogether and invented skin scrapers for this purpose. Street hawkers selling their corn remedies were a frequent sight in towns and cities across early modern Europe. The products they sold to combat corns included salves, plasters, creams, and foot baths. By the 1600s, corn cutter was a lucrative occupation. Employing your own personal cutter was a mark of aristocracy, and King George IV, Queen Victoria, and Napoleon Bonaparte were amongst those who retained personal corn cutters. Recipes for corns were often among the more pleasant of the medical recipes, with ingredients including cloves, ginger, and garlic. Although one recipe, dating from 1731, did recommend that you, quote, "anoint them often with spittle, or cleave a black snail and lay to them." Thank you for listening to this Case Notes podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, click like, or leave a positive review or comment. We really appreciate it because it helps us get higher in the rankings and reach more people. This was the final episode of our Head to Toes series. There will still be Case Notes podcasts coming out, as usual, every fortnight, though. So stay subscribed for some new series.